This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. An era ends this weekend when the syndicated TV show At the Movies airs its last episode. We'll mark its passing today by listening back to interviews with its most celebrated former hosts, Roger Ebert and the late Gene Siskel. Siskel and Ebert were dueling movie reviewers for competing Chicago newspapers, and they began appearing on television together in 1975, starting the show that went national 2 years later as Sneak Previews. In their day, their thumbs were the most sought-after parts of any film critic's anatomies. They had great on-air chemistry, but their personal rivalry was often apparent in their disagreements over films. Siskel died in 1999 after surgery to remove a brain tumor. Ebert appeared on At the Movies until 2006, when cancer surgery made it impossible for him to speak. In comments to Esquire earlier this year, Ebert wrote that he missed Siskel terribly. But he hasn't stopped working. He still reviews films for the Chicago Sun-Times and writes a blog called Roger Ebert's Journal. And a new collection of Ebert's reviews, The Great Movies 3, will be published in the fall. Terry interviewed Siskel and Ebert in 1996 in Chicago at the Thorne Theater on the campus of Northwestern University. The evening was a benefit for public radio station WBEZ.
I've asked you each to bring a scene from a favorite film, or at least a favorite scene. And I'd like to start, Roger, with the film you brought. Maybe you could tell us what the film is, and of course tell us why, of all the scenes in the world, you chose this one.
Well, Terry, I had originally picked a different scene. I picked the scene with Orson Welles being discovered by the cat in the doorway in The Third Man. And then my esteemed colleague here pointed out that that scene doesn't have any dialogue in it and so probably wouldn't play very well on the radio. We could have a kind of a United Nations translation. Okay. Now Orson Welles is smiling at Joseph Cotton, you know. So I granted Gene his point. It was a pretty good point, and I thought a little harder, and I thought of my favorite passage of dialogue in the movies, and it's from Citizen Kane, but I don't want to tell you what it is. It's from Citizen Kane. It's Mr. Bernstein, who is a person who has been, who began with Charles Foster Kane. He was there before, as he says earlier in this same scene, I was there before the beginning, and now I'm here after the end. And this is the speech that I like so much.
Okay, let's watch it.
Who's a busy man? Me? I'm chairman of the board. I got nothing but time. What do you want to know?
Well, Mr. Bernstein, we thought maybe if we could find out what he meant by his last words as he was dying.
That rosebud, huh? Maybe some girl. There were a lot of them back in the early days.
It's hardly likely, Mr. Bernstein, that Mr. Kane could have met some girl casually and then 50 years later on his deathbed.
Well, you're pretty young, Mr. Thompson. A fellow will remember a lot of things you wouldn't think he'd remember. You take me. One day back in 1896, I was crossing over to Jersey on the ferry. And as we pulled out, there was another ferry pulling in. And on it, there was a girl waiting to get off. A white dress she had on. She was carrying a white parasol. And I only saw her for 1 second. She didn't see me at all. But I'll bet a month hasn't gone by since that I haven't thought of that girl.
Yeah.
Now tell us more about what thrills you about the dialogue in that.
Well, I saw the movie for the first time in 1958. And there hasn't been a month go by since then that I haven't thought about that dialogue, because in one little speech in a popular Hollywood film written by Herman Mankiewicz, you have the mystery of memory and of longing and of the fact that we are all to some degree alone and trying to reach out to somebody else. And then you have time. You're a young man, Mr. Thompson, he says. And the more I think about that, the more you think about that speech, the more it's about the human condition. It's about the whole thing.
Do you find that your reaction to that scene or to the film in general changes as you get older? When you first saw it in 1958, you were, a teenager or a child?
Yeah, I was a teenager. child, come to think of it. Very precocious. I go to the University of Colorado every year in order to do a film a shot at a time. We spend 10 hours going with a stop-action projector or laser disc through an entire film. And every 10 years I do La Dolce Vita. I'm due to do it again. And what I said the last time was, when I saw this movie in 1962, the first time, it represented everything that I dreamed would happen to me. When I saw it the second time in 1972, it represented everything I was stuck in. When I did it at Colorado again in 1982, it represented everything I had escaped from. And the next time I do it, it will represent a pretty good movie that I remember from my youth. But the thing is, the movie has not changed. It's a time capsule. And as you see it, it evokes all of those feelings from all of those different earlier viewings. Because the movie is the same. The emotions that we bring to it are different. And if it's a good movie, because bad movies aren't worth seeing more than once, if once, but good movies are worth seeing over and over again because, like good music or a good book, they read differently every time.
Gene, what scene did you bring with you?
Well, I was sitting in the screening room having made my wise remark, and I liked his selection very much. And then I got inspired. I thought, well, you know, rather than try and come up with a famous scene from a famous movie, I'm going to pick a scene that's about his scene. It's in a very literate script, which is of a current film, 90s film. And it's about doing not what Mr. Bernstein did, which is not encountering this woman, but about encountering a woman. It is, if you will, an expanded version into an alternative way of living of what it could have been like for Mr. Bernstein if he had been an activist. It also is, without question, one of the greatest pickup scenes in the history of American film. It also is utilitarian. I am giving you a scene tonight. If you're in the sound of my voice, or this afternoon, whenever this plays, you will be able to use this. You will meet men and women using this line. Nothing else that will transpire in this interview will be as valuable as what you're about to hear. Here we go from Richard Linklater's Before Sunrise.
All right, I have an admittedly insane idea, but if I don't ask you this, it's just, you know, it's going to haunt me the rest of my life.
What?
I want to keep talking to you, you know? I have no idea what your situation is, but I feel like we have some kind of connection, right?
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, right. Well, great. So listen, here's the deal. This is what we should do. You should get off the train with me here in Vienna and come check out the
town.
What? Come on, it'll be fun. Come on.
What would we do?
I don't know. All I know is I have to catch an Austrian Airlines flight tomorrow morning at 9:30, and I don't really have enough money for a hotel, so I was just going to walk around, and it'd be a lot more fun if you came with me. And if I turn out to be some kind of psycho, you know, you just get on the next train. All right. Think of it like this. Jump ahead. 10, 20 years, okay? And you're married. And only your marriage doesn't have that same energy that it used to have, you know? You start to blame your husband. You start to think about all those guys you've met in your life and what might have happened if you picked up with one of them, right? Well, I'm one of those guys. That's me. You know, so think of this as time travel from then to now to find out what you're missing out on. See, what this really could be is a gigantic favor to both you and your future husband to find out that you're not missing out on anything. I'm just as big a loser as he is, totally unmotivated, totally boring, and you made the right choice and you're really happy.
Let me get my bag.
That's right.
That's right. That's what Mr. Bernstein should have said to that lady with the white
parasol. Isn't that fabulous? I mean, it'll work, I guarantee you. This should be shown in every sales seminar in the world.
Okay, but here's the thing. You are offering this scene somewhat tongue-in-cheek as
I'm not offering it tongue-in-cheek at all.
No.
I love the movie. That's fully scripted. It's beautifully done. I mean, obviously, the gestures that he's making that you listeners couldn't hear were wonderful acting choices. You know, he's doing with two thumbs up, oddly enough, or sideways. Come on over. Come on out. Come on out. Take that chance.
But have you ever in your life really tried to do something because you saw it in a film?
Tried
to change yourself in some way, to become another person, or to speak in a certain way, to look a certain way, because you were
You never saw Superfly?
I'd like to go through some firsts, like do a little like film biography of each of you. So let's move through these quickly. The first film you actually remember seeing in a movie theater?
Well, it would probably be a Disney picture. And the one that stands out for me for the emotional impact was Dumbo. Specifically, the sequence where Mrs. Jumbo is chained up. It's a beautiful sequence. The laughter is misplaced. It's a laughter on the title, but it's one of the most beautiful, powerful sequences in the movies. And that is, of course, when Mrs. Jumbo is, we're talking about separation between child and mother, and she sings, later will sing with her trunk woven in through the bars, one of the most beautiful lullabies, Baby Mine. Clearly, every child fears, and the Disney animated features always play on it, parental loss. That was a very powerful thing for me growing up.
Roger, first film you remember seeing in a movie?
My father took me to see the Marx Brothers in A Day at the Races. He loved the Marx Brothers. He had seen the Marx Brothers on stage in Champaign-Urbana when he was a young man.
Was it funny?
In vaudeville.
To you?
To me, the scene that I liked the very best, I was really scared when Groucho got on the horse. I was afraid he would fall off and get hurt. But the scene I remember the best is Harpo looking at me while he played the harp. He was looking straight out of the screen. He nodded at the camera, and I thought he saw me. And he was saying, look, I'm playing the harp. And I didn't know what a harp was. I'd never seen one before, and I was entranced.
Huh. The movie that most scared you as a child, that you'd
wake up and... I think I answered that question. Particularly, I will say, when Timothy J., when Dumbo's up there, and, you know, can he fly or not? Now, here you're talking about a childhood fantasy. I mean, obviously, it's a fantasy for everyone of flying, but unassisted. But he could die, and he could be humiliated. And again, this is a thing that any
Gene
child
was thinking,
would
someday
to.
I want to work with a guy like Dumbo.
Roger, the
too obvious. I'm just
the film that first
charitable
really scared
mood.
You.
20th anniversary, what the hell, you know, let it go.
When I was 10, I saw The Thing, the Howard Hawks picture. It scared me cold. I was terrified during the movie and for days afterwards.
Because of the way they burned the thing?
Oh,
they
the
set
whole,
it on fire.
The way he melted, and you could see that he was still alive.
What do you do with the vegetable?
Moment,
you
the moment it. When they form hands in a circle in the ice, and then you get the overhead shot, and you see that there's a ship underneath the ice. Everything in that movie terrified me. Among modern pictures, the first Halloween was a very scary picture.
Very.
Gene saw it at the Village Theater when he was living two blocks away, and he took a cab home.
I took a cab. Absolutely true. Absolutely true. Clark and North, and I was living at 1400 North State, and it's a little more than two blocks, but about four, and I will tell you, I took a taxi home, and when I got in, and we've all done this after scary movies, I hope, I went to the shower and pulled the curtain back. Absolutely true.
And there was nobody in the shower.
I was about 30 at the time. That sounds normal.
Knowing the kind of a housekeeper you were, it was probably a frightening sight
that
in that shower
scary.
Anyway.
That was scary.
The first movie you reviewed?
The Last Wave. It was a French film.
I thought it was an Australian film. Oh, this is a different
Last
Wave.
No, that's a different Last Wave.
Oh, okay.
And I remember The Last Wave. That was the Aborigine film. No, this was 1967. And my review was, yes, here it is, the French New Wave rolling ashore once again. You see, my first review, and I was already blasé.
My first review was of Walt Disney's Rascal.
Boy, a real Disney thing here.
Starring Billy Mummy, who was a child actor in Lost in Space. It was about a pet raccoon. And I really had to deal with the issue very quickly of hating that picture and being bold enough to stay off the gun. You're sort of knocking mom an apple pie. And I went right at it.
The first time you gave
that was
a
in late August.
Review.
I think it was August 29th, 1969.
Your first review was a negative review. Roger, was it hard the first time you wrote a negative review?
No.
You didn't think, I'm hurting people's career. People worked really hard in this movie. They're probably decent human beings. This represents
I had that
a
test come up.
Effort, even though the product isn't very
good. You have to realize you're not writing for the filmmakers, you're writing for the potential film audience. And I would much rather hurt somebody's feelings who made the picture than send somebody to see a movie and spend two hours of their life seeing a movie that I don't think is worth seeing.
The first case where I had it really tough, where I knew I was, you know, forget the constituency for Rascal and Raccoons. I saw Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid in the fall of 69. And I didn't like it. I didn't hate it. I just didn't like it. I thought it was a little contrived. And I wrote my review. And, of course, back then we wrote on typewritten pieces of paper. And I left the copy on my desk. And someone who worked as an editorial assistant, an older woman at the Tribune, came by and saw that. And I guess she had either seen a preview, maybe, you know, because sometimes journalists are invited in mass to screenings, or somehow she knew something about this picture. Certainly she knew the stars. And she said, "You didn't like that?" And I thought, oh boy. Well, I had the luxury, it was, I guess, in advance, and I had the luxury to go back and see the picture again, which I did. There was another preview. And I saw it, and I still didn't like it, and I left the review as it was. I probably, you know, re-edited it a little bit and tightened it up. But there I knew I was again at the crucible, which was, is it going to be me wanting to be liked, or is it me reflecting who I am and what I think? It applies in interviewing too. The danger is in interviewing, and the danger is wanting to be liked, if in particular you're well known. And we, again, minor celebrities, but they're still, it's important to us, and we have to let that go. We have to be willing to be hated if it comes to that, because you know what? They don't really like us, and they don't really hate us. It's the box office, the box office.
Now, you had an experience where you went back the second time, and you disliked it the second time as
yes.
much as you did the first time. Has the opposite ever happened, where maybe a day after, a month after, 10 years after you wrote a review,
of
you
course.
Went back and had a completely different reaction to it?
Well,
and
a
really
lot of movies,
something that you'd written.
The review is, basically, we see the movie once, and we write the review before the movie opens. And the review is the response to having seen the film once. Some movies, even good movies, should only be seen once, or at least at long intervals, because they're not, for example, Jaws. Great movie. You see it once, you know when the shark is going to jump, right? It plays differently when you know when the shark is going to jump. You know, as anybody knows who had to sit through an audience with a helpful type person behind them, well, the shark is about to bite, you know. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Save my money. And oftentimes when you go back, here's the thing that happens to me. I will see a bad movie, or what I think is a bad movie. And now I've been a film critic long enough. When I reviewed Bonnie and Clyde is now older than Casablanca was when I reviewed Bonnie and Clyde. So I've been a movie critic since 1967. I will go back now and see a movie that wasn't very good then and isn't very good now, but has become more interesting in the intervening 20 or 25 years simply because of the time that has passed. It is now a time capsule. It has intrinsically interesting information in it that I couldn't see at the time because when I saw it, it was now.
Right.
Some of the early motorcycle pictures, like Hell's Angels on Wheels, for example, worth seeing now because it encapsulates an attitude of the late 60s. I read an article today that really brought that back, Jane Fonda. Now, there's a spy magazine. They had great moments in Oscar history. Jane Fonda was being interviewed by a room full of journalists in her home the year that she, in 1969, she was nominated for an Academy Award. And she pulled out a joint and said, "You mind if I turn on?" And all of the journalists said, "Oh, no, go right ahead." And then she was puffing her marijuana cigarette, and her dad came home, and she ran around the room waving her arms. This made it into a Rex Reed interview. And I thought, you know, I can remember at the same year I was interviewing Robert Mitchum, and he was smoking marijuana. At the time, 69, now, if it happened now, it would be astonishing. But this late 60s were a particular season in our lives. And so movies can get better even though they aren't any better simply because they evoke associations that we didn't see the first time around.
Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel speaking with Terry Gross at Northwestern University in Chicago in 1996. At the Movies, the syndicated TV program, which was first hosted by Siskel and Ebert, will have its last broadcast this weekend. This weekend, the syndicated TV show At the Movies airs its final episode, and we're marking its passing by listening to Terry's 1996 interview with former hosts Roger Ebert and the late Gene Siskel. Before we return to that interview, though, we're going to take a short detour and hear about the film both Siskel and Ebert agreed was the best film of the 1980s, Raging Bull, directed by Martin Scorsese. Roger Ebert interviewed Scorsese at the Wexner Center for the Arts on the campus of Ohio State University in 1997, when Scorsese received the American Film Institute's Life Achievement Award and the Wexner Prize for Originality in the Arts.
Raging Bull came out in 80, and it is a great film. It is a film that will live as long as films are seen. And I think that...
Thank you. Thank you.
What I feel so strongly in talking to people about movies, frequently people will, they know I'm a movie critic, they will discuss the subject matter as if that is what the film is about. Oh, it's a film about boxing?
Yeah, I know.
Or,
right.
Oh, it's a film about gangsters or
right.
Whatever, you know, like when they hear what Breaking the Waves is about, I don't know if I want to see it. A film is not about its subject, it's about how it's about its subject.
Right. In fact, when...
Subject is neutral. People don't understand that. When people say, whenever anybody makes a statement, I don't like to go to movies about... and then fill in the blank. My response is, anyone who makes that statement is an idiot.
Mm-hmm. No, it's true. It's true. It's
I don't want to go to bad films about cowboys.
Yeah.
I don't want to go to bad films about boxers.
I know.
I would like to see a good film about a boxer. It might be a more intelligent statement.
Yeah. I mean, when Bob gave me the book originally, it's back in 1974, I never saw a fight scene. I never saw a fight. My father's a big fight fan. But I didn't know anything about boxing, and I wasn't interested in films about boxing. You know, but it took those years to for me to go my own way to come back to understanding really what it was about.
It was about a boxer, but it wasn't about boxing. It was about the boxer.
It was about a man. Yeah.
Could you set this up just a little bit by talking about two things? Number one, what people don't always they observe viscerally, but not necessarily intellectually, how much technique went into the boxing sequences in terms of slow motion and how, and lenses and movement of camera.
What happened with the boxing sequences? Once I saw De Niro. Performed the nine fights. They had Jake LaMotta and Jimmy Nicholson worked out blocking for nine fight scenes, and he showed him to me in Gleason's gym on 14th Street. And I sat there, I was stunned. In fact, he came over to me, he says, are you watching? Because I'm killing myself. I said, yeah, I am. And I realized, I said, oh boy, I said, because he didn't know, I thought I was like, you know, hanging around, not watching it. I'm watching. I realize you can't shoot this. You can't shoot this from my angle. I said we have to be in there with him, and it's got to be the Wild Bunch. It's got to be every punch has to be worked out in such a way. Or let's say not every punch, but you have to do it like music. You have to do it like I did some of the musical sequences in New York, New York, where three bars of music was one shot. Literally, not four cameras, and then you cut it together in the editing room. That's selecting, not directing. It's a different thing, you know? But directing is, you know, these four punches, one, two, three, four, camera tracks from left to right, swings around over the shoulder of the guy who's getting hit, and we see a close-up of LaMotta hitting him. And it's got to be an arc, like this, and as fast as the punches. Then do it, then on the set, we began to understand that we couldn't even see the punches. They were so fast, we had to go higher speed. 36, 48, 96, that sort of thing, just to see them. In this, you see all the speeds. But what happened was that I drew out every shot for each fight scene. There are nine fight scenes in the film. One, I didn't draw out the shots. So I think it was the second Sugar Ray fight, but I decided they was doing it with long lenses. And we put a bar of fire in front of the lens, so the heat ripples. Mm-hmm. And the most important thing was that the camera never... as much as possible, never goes outside the ring, that you're always in the ring with him. Your sensibility is taken on by his vision becomes your sensibility. In other words, what he perceives in the ring. Sometimes I open the ring up. We had a ring that I built special where I made it longer and sometimes wider. Mm-hmm. And it was like being punched in the head, what you hear and what you perceive. You don't know where you are.
And on the
it's all hallucinatory.
You used breaking glass.
Breaking glass.
And animal noises.
Animal noises and that sort of thing. Frank Warner did that. He wouldn't tell us after a while what he was using. He said, I'm not going to tell anybody. You know, that's whatever it is, it's great. It's, you know, that sort of thing. Pulling out the sound, putting in the sound. All kind. We even changed speeds during a shot, which now you can do very easily with a button, but then you had to actually do with a non-blimped ARRI, and you had to change the motor and also the left stop with two assistants, that sort of thing. But in any event, what I'm saying is that it was all designed, and they were all designed shot A, B, C, D, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and they all were cut together. And some of the cutting of the fight scenes was the easiest to do because it was all laid out. Mm-hmm. But it did take, we had planned 5.5 weeks of shooting for it. It did take 10 weeks. And it was very specific. And De Niro would have on the side of the camera a very big punching bag, one of those cylinder ones. It looks like a cylinder. And he, and we were ready to yell. We were ready to go for a roll. We'd have the slate ready, you know, and start rolling. And you hear off camera, punching the bag. And then he'd jump into frame, sweating, you know, and then the slate. Mm-hmm. So he came in already heated, bang, ready to go. It wasn't like, you know, wasting any footage. But the physical stamina it took him to sustain 10 weeks of that was amazing. And because he believed in the shots I wanted to get. But what you see here is the final battle, in a way, and the punishment he takes, especially the montage when he gets beaten up by Sugar Ray, is based, in a way, the drawings I made were based on the shower scene from Psycho. And I shot it in that way. There were 39 shots, and it took 10 days just to shoot those shots. Because there were applications and all kinds of makeup problems, and just to get the angle right, it was like 10 days. And there's even a shot in there Sam Fuller told me about. He said, put the lens in somebody's hand and just swing this way. Right? You'll see it. We even put the camera on the boxing glove, and the glove is in the foreground and comes flying at him this way. It's all in there for like maybe 5 frames, 6 frames, you know.
Let's look.
You know, okay.
We have LaMotta on Clear Street holding on. Well, certainly that was one of the most damaging evidences of punching that you have seen in recent years.
Come on! Come on! What are you standing for?
Robinson, apparently tired, punched with a fairly well and rocked Jake LaMotta right to the heel.
Come on, Ray.
One thing I forgot to say before it started was that the announcer's voice, that's the actual announcer of the actual fight. The phrases he used, and it was hard to get his voice out through the stereo and that sort of thing. It's hard to hear sometimes, but the lines he used is amazing. No man can take this punishment. That's all real. That's actually as it was happening, you know.
Obviously, the film is in black and white.
Yeah.
It came at a time when you were involved in a battle with Eastman over the fading
color
stock, but yeah. Apart from that, didn't you believe that this film had to be in black and white?
Yeah, I believe that because an old friend of mine, Gene Kirkwood, walked by my office and said, remember, Sweet Smell of Success. That's a great film by Alexander McKendrick with Burt Lancaster and Tony Curtis, really sort of based on Walter Winchell, mm-hmm. and had extraordinary black and white photography of New York and that world, really, James Wong Howe photography, 1950-something, 55, I think, 56, 57. Anyway, I thought of that, and I also knew that there were 4 or 5 other boxing films coming out that year. There was the main event, Barbara Streisand, and well, a comedy,
John Boy,
was it?
Yeah.
No, it wasn't John. It was
Jackie.
Ryan O'Neal. Barbara Streisand. And there was Rocky II or Rocky III, I think. And there was a couple of others, and there was even Matilda, the boxing kangaroo in color.
Right.
I said, think of it. I said, Oz is the only one in black and white. It's got to be different, you know?
Martin Scorsese speaking with Roger Ebert in 1997. Our thanks to the Wexner Center for the Arts at Ohio State University, where their conversation was recorded. This weekend marks the end of the syndicated TV show At the Movies, and we're listening to Terry's 1996 interview with former hosts Roger Ebert and the late Gene Siskel, recorded at the Thorne Theater on the campus of Northwestern University.
You both have done profiles of actors in addition to reviewing movies. You write feature stories. My experience is that sometimes actors are very temperamental, and that if you're not asking them questions that will help them promote their film, if you go what publicists like to call off-topic, that they'll sometimes get very temperamental and even walk out.
It didn't used to be that way. I mean, the key word in your observation is publicist. When I started, you kind of hung out with the stars. I mean, Gene and I remember a day when John Wayne came to town to see his friend Stepan Fetchett, who was dying in University of Chicago Hospital. And he called up the movie critics and said, come on over here to the Conrad Hilton, and we'll drink some tequila and talk. And we, the four movie critics at that time, turned up, you know, with our tongues hanging out, delighted to just sit around and talk with the Duke for a while. Well, these days, of course, with spin control, you'd have somebody feeding him his sound bites, you know. And I've done many interviews in the past where you really got to spend time with a person in an unstructured environment, maybe in an environment where they didn't always look their best. As, for example, the day I spent with Lee Marvin when he was dead drunk. And yet it was a very good story. He liked it. He talked to me again many times later in his career. He thought it was a good story about that day. These days, the publicists only want to present the soundbite opportunity. And the sad thing is, the lessons they've learned in promoting movies are now being used in promoting politicians. And we are getting the same spin control on politicians that we get on movie stars.
Did you have any publicists from Lee Marvin's movie call you up and say, please don't mention that he was drunk. Please don't quote certain things that he
please
said.
Please don't mention that the dog came out of his bedroom with a pair of panties in its mouth, and his girlfriend said, whose are those panties? And Lee Marvin said, Michelle, those are your panties. And she said, those are not my panties. And Marvin said, bad dog.
Did anyone ask you not to quote that?
That's right in the story. It's in there.
Any repercussions?
The publicist was there the whole time. He was going out to get more beer.
I got out of the interviewing business because of the influence of publicists to a degree, to a large degree. I was doing them all the time and enjoyed it tremendously. About 6 years ago, I'm guessing, it's about 6 years ago, a film called Postcards from the Edge by Mike Nichols came out, Meryl Streep, Shirley MacLaine. And Mike Nichols and I are, there's a group of journalists. I had private time because of my larger circulation, I guess, of my newspaper. And television, of course. So I sat with the other journalists who had to sit at a group. And I just sat at the table listening. When I do that, what I'm really doing is listening to the questions so I know which one will get boring answers and I don't ask them, waste my time. Mike Nichols turns to me and says, there was a lull. I said, may I ask a question to my colleagues, because they had limited time. Go right ahead. I said, what do you mean by the last shot in Working Girl, which is a big pullback? I thought it was a great shot, a pullback from the office building. And he said, you know, one of many stories, that kind of thing. Okay. He said, what did you think of the last shot in this picture? Now he's crossing the line because I haven't reviewed the film. It's okay. And I said, I normally don't discuss but I'll be happy to. I didn't like it. I said, you summed up everything with a song. You remember Meryl Streep sings a song and everything's hunky-dory and, you know, this is an addiction film and she's even got the relationship going on with Hackman and all that. And I said, it just doesn't work that way. And fine. Now he leaves. And I explained to the other journalists, I said, well, you know, I want you to know, I actually like the picture, it's just that I didn't like the ending. So if you see me give a positive review, I'm trying to protect myself now, please know that it wasn't that my mind changed, but he asked me about one scene, and I told him about one scene, end. The next day, interviews are canceled. And they're too busy. and including
your
Nichols,
interview.
My interviews with Nichols, Streep, not McClane. So I go to Shirley MacLaine. I'm steamed. I'm steamed because, come on, this is juvenile. He asked the question. I didn't go around picking on him. I would end up writing him a letter explaining this. I got most everything in my life from writing letters. And I said, he turned around and he did do an interview with me. And I'll tell you what he said, because it involves Roger too. What Mike Nichols said was, he said, "You guys..." He says, I said, "Why are you making such a big deal about me?" You know, I mean, you know, he says, "Well, because you can actually affect," this comes back to your earlier question, he says, "this is, you can actually affect the box office."
Well, I bet you've learned interesting things about what it means to be a celebrity in America through the own recognition you've achieved as film critics.
A long time ago, I interviewed Michael Caine. He came to America to make a movie called Hurry Sundown with Otto Preminger, after having become a success in Alfie and the Ipcress File. And I said, "What does it feel like to be a movie star?" And he said, "You can't go into a dirty bookstore anymore." He said, "I tried it." He says, "In England, we don't have the kind of pornography you have over here, but I'd heard about the stores in Times Square. And so I looked in through the window of one of them. I was curious." You remember Michael Caine at this time was in his 20s, young man, first trip to America.
Yeah.
I looked in through the window with my trained actor's eye. I wish I could do his Cockney accent. With my trained actor's eye, I quickly realized that there was no eye contact in a porno store. Everybody looks as tunnel vision. Nobody looks at anybody else. And I realized, he says, and this is the way an actor would notice this. And I congratulated myself. I said, "Michael, you can walk right in there because nobody will look at you." So I walked right in. But he said, "Unfortunately, there was a gent on an elevated stool with a microphone whose job it was to say, 'Okay, gents, this isn't a library. Make your purchases.'" And he got on his microphone and said, "Look who we have in the rubberware section, Michael Caine." And to a degree, that's when he told me that, I was not on television. I didn't realize that's what happens. You can't flip the bird to anybody in traffic. You always have to be nice to people on the elevator because they know who you are and they're going to tell everyone, if you were not nice. And whatever you do, it's going to get back to you or...
And enlarged.
Enlarged, yeah.
Now, has that affected the way you interview movie stars? Because you've experienced to some extent...
Well, I'll tell you what has affected me more, and I've thought about that, because the first big star I interviewed was John Wayne, and I was completely intimidated.
Mm-hmm.
It was during the filming of the Green Berets, and there was an overhead shot that was being set up so nobody out of uniform could be visible on this airfield. So they told him on a walkie-talkie that the interviewer was there, and he came walking in full battle fatigues with a helmet and a rifle and a sidearm and a radio and a canteen and grenades and a backpack and boots and knives and, you know, bayonets, walking toward me for about a quarter of a mile. And I couldn't move. I had to wait in the shade. He got up to me, he stuck out a hand, and he said, "John Wayne." And I said, "I know." And later, as I began to interview people of comparable stature who were younger, such as Robert De Niro or Meryl Streep, I realized a funny thing. For all of us, movie stars are the people who were stars when we were growing up. If they're your age or younger, they're just people.
Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel interviewed on stage in Chicago in 1996 at a benefit for the Chicago public radio station WBEZ. At the Movies, the syndicated TV show which they started, will have its last broadcast this weekend. Roger Ebert continues to write reviews for the Chicago Sun-Times and has a new collection of film reviews coming out in the fall. Gene Siskel died in 1999 after surgery to remove a brain tumor. Our thanks to the staff at WBEZ for recording this event. Arcade Fire is a Montreal-based band that's grown in popularity from an obscure indie favorite to a group that can fill Madison Square Garden in less than a decade. The band's third album is called The Suburbs, and rock critic Ken Tucker says it has the sweep and ambition of a rock opera.
And the suburbs are... Survive. Grab your mother's keys, we'll leave.
Arcade Fire is at once obvious and subtle, which could stand as one definition of a good popular rock band. If this group calls its new album The Suburbs, you can be sure that that's what an awful lot of its 16 tracks are about. Frontman Win Butler, raised in the burbs outside of Houston, Texas, knows enough about his subject to be ambivalent about them. On the one hand, the title song talks about the ticky-tack construction of suburban developments. On the other hand, it embraces the shared, sheltered culture of middle-class life without hostility or condescension. So one reason Arcade Fire has become an indie act that fills stadiums is the scope of its musical ambition. Their songs have the scale and sweep of anthems, and anthems sound most completed when there's a large audience to respond to them. The current version of Arcade Fire is a seven-piece band that builds momentum within each song, unfurling guitar chords that ripple alongside the windiness of the band's lyrics. I don't mean windy as an insult. Butler sings the grand, garrulous verses with the serene patience of a man who enjoys contemplating how best to live one's life. Arcade Fire may attempt arena rock as overreaching as anything Bruce Springsteen or U2 has achieved, but the band also keeps the ideas specific and thoughtful. They sing lines such as, "I want a daughter while I'm still young," or, as on this song, "City with no children," considering how to behave before, quote, "A world war does with us whatever it will do." Many of the songs on The Suburbs stretch on past 4 or 5 minutes and occasionally need to be broken into two parts or movements to achieve their full effect. That effect is nearly rock operatic, the music sometimes matching one of their song titles, Rococo. But Arcade Fire manages the difficult task of shaping songs to match the guitar hook or the refrain the band wants to implant in your mind. And they know the value of changing up the pace and varying the style. At a time when most cool kid bands are intent on churning out either chaotic sprawl or hip-hop-inflected hit singles, Arcade Fire is an unabashed album band. In fact, that's the phrase Win Butler has used in interviews, quote, "We're an album band." They see a collection of songs as their primary unit of creativity. They're going for the cumulative effect. They want their audience to spend time making connections between the songs and knitting them together, to make the suburbs something other than a crazy quilt of alienation. It's difficult to do that without sounding derivative or self-consciously retro, but Arcade Fire has found a way to do it, with sincerity and vigor and with frequently glorious results.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.